I want to begin with a CD that came out a couple of years ago. It has nothing to do with Dan Brown, but it's a great song.
There is friction in the space between the lines on the page and memories. Write it down, but it doesn't mean that just telling stories.
Singer-songwriter who began in Boston, singing in Harvard Square and made it big. This is from a marvelous CD called Telling Stories, which she wrote after breaking up with a famous writer, African-American writer named Alice Walker. So the story is really telling stories. It's about the fictions that she found in her own life, in her own relationship. But I think it's a good place to begin tonight. I'll just read the words if you couldn't understand them. There is fiction in the space between the lines on your page of memories. Write it down, but it doesn't mean you're not just telling stories. There is fiction in the space between you and me. There is fiction in the space between you and reality. You will do and say anything to make your everyday life seem less mundane. There is fiction in the space between you and me. She's a great songwriter, and that's a great CD, and it's a great song. Mm-hmm. And I use it to begin because I think in some ways the only way to understand the phenomenal success of this novel of Dan Brown's has something to do with our deep yearning for fiction and to tell different stories about what's between us and reality, whatever reality is. But those of you, is there anybody here who hasn't read the book? A few? Okay. Well, I wouldn't urge you to go out and read it, certainly not buy it. It's not a particularly well-written book, but I think as a book, it's a fascinating foray into themes that have ignited a fervor among many, many people in our cult times, at least certain parts of our culture. And I must say, at some point, I need to write Dan Brown a nice thank you note because he's given me a lot of work over the last 3 years. In fact, he's put my daughter through a year of college. Fees from talking about the book. I'm actually sort of weary of it, but I do it today. I first encountered this book in December of 2003. It came out in the spring of 2003, and it was a phenomenon in the very beginning. It's probably been the best marketed book ever to appear in the United States. Even more effectively marketed than Rowling's books on Harry Potter, because that kind of took over by itself. But this book really was maneuvered by the publisher and by Dan Brown to remarkable success. You name a TV show, a morning show, an evening show that Dan Brown hasn't been on, and I'd be amazed. He's been on every show. And if you don't believe me, check his website. You can even download all of the interviews and watch them for yourself.
I don't even know what he looks like because
he's on the back of the book.
I have a paperback.
So anyway, I was invited by a former student, a pastor of a church, to come and give a talk on this book, and I figured I'd better read it first before I talked about it. I was flying to Germany to give a lecture, and wandering through the airport at Logan Airport, there were mountains of this book at every bookstore. There still are. I mean, it's still on the bestseller list. And so I picked one up and put it on the put it under my arm and got on the airplane. But as a professional historian, you know, I thought maybe I should just take the cover off because I didn't really want to see people, you know, have people see that I was actually reading this pulp fiction. Well, of the 250 people on that plane, probably about 80 of them had the book. I'm not kidding. It was a phenomenon already at that time. And we could have had a book reading group in the most of the business section, or probably the entire business section. But I want to think with you a little bit tonight about why this book and why it's an important book, because I've already said it's, I think, fairly silly as a historical book. But I think there is an importance to the book, because I wouldn't say 40 million people can't be wrong. 40 million people can be wrong. They're wrong all the time. Regularly at election times, 40 million people are wrong. And, you can tell my political leanings. But I think there's something in this book that really behooves us as Christians to take notice of where the hungers are and where the fascinations are. And in that sense, I think it's a really important book for us to know something about. So all week, next week, I'll be talking about the Da Vinci Code, but not just the book, really about themes that the book raises, about the whole question of conspiracies. I think that's really one of the most important dimensions of this book that's been quite underplayed. This book came out in April of 2003. And in March of 2003, as you all know, our country went into a major war based on a conspiracy theory, which we later found out was an absolute pack of lies. But at the time, I think we all felt, most of us at least, and I would count myself as an ardent liberal among those who felt, if these things are true that have been said about Saddam Hussein, that there must be something that must be done to counter this rampant evil. Not to downplay Saddam Hussein's evilness, or propose that he has some kind of goodness we haven't noticed yet, but clearly there was on many of our minds a sense of large conspiracies that were immense, that were violent, and that could affect us in some irrational way. That could somehow affect all of us. That's what we were sold as a bill of fear, and that's what most of us at least ingested, particularly throughout that year, 2003, until bit by bit the whole conspiracy became unraveled as a pack of lies and deceptions, public deceptions. But this book, I think, gave us something easy to worry about, a conspiracy that really was a kind of interesting conspiracy. It really didn't affect most of us directly. It did reshape basic things about the Christian story, and there were many people who were quite concerned about that. A whole host of my colleagues wrote books, I think hoping to get on the bandwagon, about all the untruths in Dan Brown's book. I even contributed a small piece to that parade. But basically, I don't think that's a very interesting thing for you to listen to me talk about or for us to think about this week. So I'll simply step by that issue. We can come back to it from day to day if you're interested in taking up particular topics of it. But I think there is something about the conspiracy theory, the whole notion of conspiracies, that fascinates us. Brown has one of his characters in two different places in the book state the obvious. Everyone loves a conspiracy. And no one probably as much as Americans. We seem particularly fascinated with conspiracies. Big ones. Complicated ones. Difficult ones. And, if you think that somehow this doesn't affect you, and it may not affect you, you just have to look at the younger culture and the fascination with this book as a telling of the Christian story or retelling of the story from a very different slant, as a story of all kinds of plots and conspiracies. I think it's also a story that reminds us of the importance of fiction. And Brown has never been anything but straightforward about the fact that this is a novel, but it's a strange kind of novel because it's based on and it presumes to tell historical facts, or retell historical facts, or tell the facts that have been obscured deliberately for millennia. That's a pretty grand idea. And of course, the church, the churches, the Christian community, has not been without its lies and deceptions, and has not been without its obfuscation of realities that it didn't like. And of course, this also came out right at the beginning of the terrible, tragic fiasco that has come unraveled about the pedophilia crisis in the Catholic Church. I'm from Boston. Boston was one of the first places hit hard But it's coming out now all over the world, not just in the U.S., in South America, in Europe, in parts of Asia. That the pedophilia crisis is not a small issue that the church has got to face, and it certainly is something that has been covered over for generations by bishops, by archbishops, and even by popes, who have refused to face the reality of sexual abuse of children in our communities, and particularly in our churches. So all of these things, I think, made a kind of a perfect climate for this book to take off, just like wildfire. Probably the wrong metaphor to use at Holden. Just like a crazy, crazy thing happening. Why should we read this book? Why should we even think about it this week? I think primarily because this is a book about hunger. And Brown gets at certain kinds of hunger of the soul and hunger of the body as well as anybody. And that's what we'll spend a lot of our time this week talking about. These are also themes that have been strangely quiet, silenced in many of our churches. The whole question of the erotic power of human experience is something that, for the most part, we don't say anything about. I mean, we have a few words, no or not yet, that we tell our youth, young people, but for the most part, we really don't deal very clearly with sexuality, with issues of gender, with issues of power. And this book, although it treats them in sometimes, I think, a rather cavalier fashion, raises these issues and I think touches deep concerns and angers and especially frustrations in many people. I would say it's also a book that's blatantly not just anti-Christian, or at least anti-Christian in the big story, but anti-Catholic. And I've found this for 3 years. I've been giving talks all over the country about the Da Vinci Code and about issues that it raises. And chronically, the audiences are primarily women and primarily middle-aged and older women. And often, the one thing that this book told them is that the church was wrong. That the church was wrong in silencing them and not providing them a place of dignity and not offering them avenues of service and leadership. And I think in many ways, Brown hits this right on the head. He hits this nail right on the head. That in some ways, I think Brown understands an animosity and a frustration among many, not just women, but certainly women, first of all, who've lived with the church's refusals of their gifts and their graces for not just years, but indeed generations, centuries, even millennia. So enough of that. I mean, why the book has been so popular. I want to think with you about three themes tonight, and then we'll have some time for conversation. And if you're here through next week, we'll have ample time to unpack these, I hope. And if you're only here tonight and leaving tomorrow morning, I'll linger afterwards. We can talk a bit more, more informally. I think there are three things that this book does brilliantly well, or at least three themes that are crucially important that Brown gets at in a somewhat clumsy way, but he does get them. First is the importance of mystery. Of mystery. And, you know, I would have to say that in many of our churches, if you were an anthropologist with no understanding of Christianity, and you landed in a typical white congregation, whether Lutheran or Presbyterian or UCC, my tribe, certainly the non-sacramental churches particularly, and you were writing a field report after you observed this group of people for a number of months, probably one word that you wouldn't talk about is mystery, that there was anything mysterious going on, that we seem to understand everything or presume that we understand everything, and we often have forced, I think, and in the long tradition of liberal Protestantism, of progressive Protestantism, we've often, I think, seen our faith largely in terms of what we do, how we act, or how we should act, and what we should do. And there's nothing wrong with this. I think it's one of the great contributions of the progressive tradition in modern Christianity. But there's certainly much more that's not said when we simply talk about our activities and our actions. And in the longer scope, the church has never really neglected mystery. In fact, if anything, it erred on the side of mystery and refused to embrace rationality, vigorous critical thinking. And part of our tradition, I think, is a reaction to that. But clearly, I think Brown understands the importance of mystery in human experience. And here he presents it, I think, in a number of ways, strange ways, talking about the esoteric, talking about these mysterious rituals and rites that happen secretly in hidden places, basements of chateaus in France. I mean, how could you get more exotic than that? And these rites involve sex, and there's some kind of intrigue and fascination with them. Okay, it's kind of old people copulating on a stone altar. That might turn some of you on, and others it might leave rather indifferent. But there it is. There's something about our need to understand that reality is more than what we can know with our minds. And Brown's characters in this novel, I think, amply get at that theme. Christianity is certainly a life that involves an attention to our duties and responsibilities, but it's got to be more than that. And I do see, at least in traditions that are gaining strength and power in the modern, in our culture, in North America, the emergent church movement, which uses all kinds of ancient rituals and mysterious things as ways of reminding us that our world is bigger than the list of duties and responsibilities that we are up against. Walt Brueggemann, a colleague, an Old Testament scholar, recently retired from Columbia Seminary in Decatur, Georgia. Brueggemann described the world we lived in, it's I think a wonderful phrase, as a prose-flattened world. A prose-flattened world. And by that he means no disrespect to prose, but a sense that there is an almost aversion to the poetic in our time. Poetry which is symbolic, poetry which evokes and provokes. It doesn't explain, but it evokes something in us, it provokes something in us. But this prose-flattened world is a world that most of us are dying to escape from, to find some alternative to. And a book like Brown's book at least touches, I think, on this yearning for something mysterious, for something symbolic, something larger and more wondrous than the workaday world that grinds us in the duties and responsibilities of our lives. In a marvelous play that hit Broadway, like gangbusters a few years ago, by Mary Zimmerman, Metamorphoses, did you see it? Quite stunning. A retelling of these ancient stories of Ovid, this Greek teller of the ancient myths and stories. There's one scene where one of the characters has this to say. It's been said that the myth is a public dream. The myth is a public dream, and dreams are private myths. It's been said that the myth is a public dream, and dreams are private myths. Unfortunately, we give our mythic side scant attention these days, and so a great deal escapes us, and we no longer understand our very actions. So it remains important and salutary to speak not only of the rational and the easily understood, but also of enigmatic things, the irrational and the ambiguous, to speak both privately and publicly, to speak of irrational things, ambiguous things, poetic things. I think in some ways what Brown's novel does effectively is to make us think again about the stories we thought we'd understood the first time. To think about some of the characters in those stories. We'll talk at some length this week about Mary Magdalene. A minor story, but significant story in the canonical Gospels, the Gospels that got into the New Testament, and a figure who appears in all kinds of other writings in the ancient world, which we've lumped under the name the Gnostic Gospels. I know some of you know something about the Gnostic Gospels. One of you was reading Elaine Pagel's book called The Gnostic Gospels, or at least it was sitting on the table. So there are these characters in the stories that we don't know much about. And in point of fact, for hundreds and hundreds of years, up until the early modern period, preachers understood one of their primary tasks To make these stories larger and more fascinating and compelling than they were in the Bible. That they understood their task as enlarging the biblical stories. And then came the rise of a historical awareness, a sense that we ought to understand critically what these texts really meant, to understand them in their original setting and so on. And we reversed directions. And so for 500 years, at least in the critical tradition of Christianity, the Protestant tradition above all, we've thought differently about the Bible. We've tried to reduce the fiction in the Bible, to discover the fact, only the facts. Give me the facts and only the facts from the Bible. And bit by bit, historians have helped us understand that actually there aren't many facts in the Bible. It doesn't pretend to be. It doesn't present itself as a fact collection or even as a book of history. It presents itself as stories that have shaped communities. And the Gospels are very straightforward about this, John's Gospel particularly, which ends with a disclaimer that there were many things not written in these books, this book. And if we wrote them all down, we wouldn't have enough books to fill them up with. But these things were written so that you might believe, and that believing you might have life. The Gospels are written for a purpose. They're not written as history. They weren't understood as history by the communities that first remembered them. They didn't have a sense of history like we have. And so these stories, which were imaginative retellings of memories of Jesus and of his followers, took many forms. And only in the last 50 years have we discovered a whole new collection of these Gospels, sometimes called the Gnostic Gospels. In fact, one came out earlier this year, the Gospel of Judas. Any of you read it? Fascinating. A short little book, 10 pages or so. You can download it on the web from the National Geographic site. A fascinating story, giving Judas actually a good role. That Judas becomes the good guy, not the bad guy, not the hit guy, not the scapegoat, but Judas becomes the kind of inside friend of Jesus necessary for the story to take place. So too with Mary Magdalene, one of the stories, one of the mysterious characters in our Gospels and in many other ancient documents from the early Christian period. Mary Magdalene was a compelling figure. She is, in the canonical Gospels, the first to witness the resurrected Jesus. And already in the early church, she was called the Apostle to the Apostles. In fact, there's a famous icon of Mary standing, robed, teaching with her hand up in the gesture of the teacher, teaching the 11 fearful, cowardly, ignorant disciples, the men, who refused to come back to the tomb, for the most part, although perhaps Peter came with one in one of the Gospels. But Mary is, in all of the Gospels, portrayed as the faithful one who came first and who stayed to the very end. And because of the power of the story of the resurrection, in the early church at least, Mary was considered to be a preeminent figure, a primary figure in the story. And bit by bit, historians over the last generations have begun to reassess Mary Magdalene as perhaps a clue to a role for women that the early church eventually refused to follow and silenced. But in that first generation, perhaps, not just Mary Magdalene, there were other women. Paul names some in his letter to the Romans, in the very last chapter, an important chapter where he lists the people he wants to have remembered, himself remembered to in Rome. A third of the women, a third of the names of those who were leading the churches in Rome were women. So we'll think about the role of women in early Christianity, in particular the role of Mary Magdalene, and think about how Mary Magdalene opens a world of wonder and a world of mystery to us still today. So if wonder is, I think, one of the themes the book gets at, the second is beauty. Beauty. beauty understood in many different ways in this novel. Sometimes I think rather crudely, rather clumsily, and even rather stupidly. But the theme keeps coming back over and over again. And it's a theme that our churches, I think, often have remained strangely silent about. We talk about what's true, we talk about what's good, what's morally responsible, but often we don't say much about beauty. And beauty is really at the very heart of that classic triduum, that classic threefold notion, triad, of the good, the true, and the beautiful. So I think in some ways Brown understands that a version of Christianity that doesn't attend to the nature of beauty isn't going to have much staying power and much depth. And we'll think about that throughout the week. Christianity is a way of seeing. It's a way of seeing. One of our modern writers, a marvelous woman named Jeanette Winterson, described poetry and fiction. She said, it's not another version of the facts. It's a different way of seeing. Poetry and fiction don't just give us the facts differently, or different facts. They welcome us, they invite us to look at the world differently, to pause and to reframe what we see in the world. One of the great contributions, I think, of our writers and writers through the ages. And strangely enough, I think Brown ought to, at least, even if he frustrates some of us, even angers some of us for what he does with the ancient Christian stories, I think one of the marvelous things he's done is to open those stories in fresh ways. To ask us to think again, to read again, to see again, to look again, because these stories are not done with us. So, wonder and beauty, and I think the third theme that this book gets at so profoundly is the sacred feminine. What he calls the sacred feminine. Something of a tagline in Brown's hands, I'm afraid. And it's hard to know exactly what he means by it, but it's not hard to know what others who've spoken and written for years, for generations, about the sacred feminine have been in tune with. Embodied ways of knowing, beyond simply rational forms of discourse. Wisdom as a form of engaged knowing, a form of knowing that takes our very lives into its hands. Passion as a way of life. And indeed, a version of Christianity without passion probably isn't worth more than the price of the paper you can print it on. Passion as a way of life. Imagination. The importance of imagination. The sacred feminine opens a very different kind of imagination. The patriarchal imagination of power and domination, of manipulation, and of control. And so the sacred feminine is a different way of opening reality. I think Brown gets at this, at least he names it, and provokes in many of us, I think, a hunger to hear more. So there's a lot that isn't in this book, and by the end of the week, we'll think a little bit about those things. I think they're important, because it's a form of religion, Christianity or religion, that doesn't ask any commitment of us, none whatsoever. It leaves us, I think, in our own individual experience. It's a very American book in that sense, a very modern an American book. It doesn't ask us to commit ourselves to anyone else. There is no struggle on behalf of those who are most vulnerable in this book. It's a kind of triumphalist book. And it's a quick kind of beach book. I mean, it's a beach read. It's an airplane read. So it doesn't ask to be more than that. But I think for those of us reading this book and responding to it, we would clearly want to say there's much more at the heart of Christianity than certain new kinds of feelings, even new kinds of perceptions and imaginings. That at the heart of the Christian community, tradition, is a sense that we belong together as people. That our life is shaped by the commitments, by the engagements that we have with each other and for others around us. And this is a book that has no costly grace, as Dietrich Bonhoeffer would have said. Cheap grace, easy grace, comfortable grace, convenient grace, even powerful grace, but not profound grace, and certainly not costly grace. So we'll have to think through this week, not just about what's wrong with the book, to list the errors of the book, that doesn't really interest me much, but rather where this book provides, I think, a beginning place for a conversation within Christian communities about what we really ought to be up to as Christians, what we really ought to be on to as Christians. And certainly it's not going to be the religion of Robert Langdon, this symbologist. You know, it's sort of funny because Harvard University, he's a professor at Harvard University, they have literally hundreds, probably 1,000 chairs, academic chairs. But they don't have this one yet. I'm convinced that Dan Brown, one of his most ironic gestures, and there aren't many in this court, but maybe he'll find some irony, and will endow a chair at Harvard in symbology. It's hard to know if the trustees would accept it, but they might. But I hope that this week will give us a chance to think together, not just about this book, but through this book, about things that truly matter for us as Christians in our day and age. To think about the power and the importance of fiction, the kinds of fictions that we write and tell, the ones that are life-affirming, that create community, that get at issues of justice, that listen to the poor, that take heed to the most vulnerable in our community and in our world. And that rarely have we been at such a perilous time as a world, community, and I think in need of much greater attention to the kinds of commitments and engagements that call us to a higher way than simply reading a book like this and thinking about it. I want to end, and we'll leave a good time for conversation together, questions and comments. I want to end with just pointing to one page, and I'm sure it's an important page because it's page 444. There are no accidents in this book. I'm just 444. Three fours. It must be important, right? Those of you who've read the book get the point. Langdon, Robert Langdon, this professor who's gone through 2 days with no sleep, no food, no bathroom stops as far as we can tell, nothing, racing around France and England and Scotland eventually. So just before the novel ends, he's up in Roslyn, this little community south of Edinburgh in Scotland, at this chapel, where he's gone with Sophie Nevers. And of course, if you unravel Sophie Nevers, you get the kind of the place of wisdom. The venue. Everything has a symbol, a kind of riddle here. The venue of Sophia. The venue of Sophia. The place of. And she, as you know, as you discover in the novel, she is Mary Magdalene. Did you catch that? It's kind of a subtle thing. It you rush by it, turning these pages to get to the next episode. It's in about the third chapter from the end. You finally realize that the womb of Mary Magdalene, which carried the children of Jesus, as Brown tells the story. He's not the first to invent this idea, by the way. He just picks it up. That there's a lineage, a matriarchal lineage, that begins with Mary Magdalene, and there has to be, in every generation, a present incarnation. And in Brown's telling, it's Sophie Nevers. So you know at the end of the novel that Robert Langdon, who's desperately attracted to her, well, not in the movie, if you saw the movie, there's not much attraction between these two, but Tom Hanks? Yeah. What can you say?
I would have chosen those people.
No, it probably wouldn't work, but anyway, you know that they're going to Florence. At the end of the novel, he's got another academic conference, and she says, well, I'll go with you as long as we don't go to any lectures. And you realize they don't even need a room with a view. Any room is going to work, you know, right? So they're going to have this entertainment, this escapade in Florence. But before the novel ends, Robert Langdon encounters this older woman. Remember Marie Chauvel? And Marie Chauvel turns out to be the long-lost grandmother, right?
Yes.
Of Sophie Nevers, whom she never knew existed because of her parents' mysterious death and so on as a young child. And they have this encounter, which begins on page, I don't know, 4 or something. But on page 444, there is this this interlude. Langdon is trying to figure out where, in fact, the Grail is. The whole book is about the quest for the Holy Grail. And only at the end do we discover that the Grail is Mary Magdalene. She contains the blood. She births the blood of Jesus, the offspring. And so Sophie is the Grail. She's the present version of the Grail, walking around. Anyway, so he's trying to rethink all of these things he thought he knew about the Holy Grail. And here's right at the end of the story. Was the church pressuring your husband, Langdon is talking, not to release the Sangreal documents at the end of days? This is a whole prior design thing, which we can talk about if you want. Heavens no, she says. The end of days is a legend of paranoid minds. If you're going to follow Barbara Rossing's talks this week, you realize how powerful the paranoia is, the paranoia of the end of days. There it is. It's a legend of paranoid minds. There's nothing in the Priory Doctrine that identifies a date at which the Grail should be unveiled. In fact, she goes on, the Priory has always maintained that the Grail should never be unveiled. Never? Langdon was stunned. The first time in the novel he was stunned. Marie Chauvel goes on, it is the mystery and wonderment that serve our souls, not the Grail itself. The beauty of the Grail lies in her ethereal nature. She gazed up at Rosalind at the chapel now. For some, she said, the Grail is a chalice that will bring them everlasting life. For others, it's the quest for lost documents and secret history. And for most, I suspect the Holy Grail is simply a grand idea, glorious, unattainable treasure that somehow, even in today's world of chaos, inspires us. Langdon. But if the Sangreal documents remain hidden, the story of Mary Magdalene will be lost forever. Will it? She said. Look around you. Her story is being told in art, music, and books, more so every day. The pendulum is swinging. We are starting to sense the dangers of our own history and of our destructive paths. We are beginning to sense the need to restore the sacred feminine. She paused. You mentioned you're writing a manuscript about the symbols of the sacred feminine, are you not? I am, he said. She smiled. Finish it, Mr. Langdon. Sing her song. The world needs modern troubadours. He fell silent, feeling the weight of her message upon him. It's a fascinating little episode, isn't it? I think there's something here that Brown gets right. But there is something in us that yearns for a deeper sense of the mystery of our life, of the wonder of our life, of the possibility that actually singing, the arts, might be a more direct way, a more immediate way of expressing our deepest faith than the arguments and declarations and reasons that we can provide. Now, Langdon isn't the first to think this. And Dan Brown isn't the first to write about it. But I think Brown has caught something that bears attending to, that there is something in us that yearns for a glorious, unattainable treasure that somehow in today's chaos, world of chaos, can still inspire us. Is this book the answer? I don't think so. But I think Brown never really sought to be the answer, but rather to ask the question. And it's these questions that we'll be living with this week, thinking through together, and imagining in the work we'll do in rethinking early Christian history, medieval history, and thinking about the kind of burdens and the bounties of what it means to be more faithfully Christian in our day and age. So that's it as a starter for tonight. And I welcome your questions or responses, comments. Still have about 15 minutes. Yeah, please.
I enjoyed the book just as a I like mystery novels, and I like all the puzzles. And
yeah, I think that's one of the fascinations.
At the point that you read it was the only place in the book where my hair stood up.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Say more about that. Why is your hair stand up?
The book seemed to change at that point.
Yeah.
It actually seemed to open up into something more than just a chase.
Yeah, I think it does.
It's been interesting for me as a pastor, you know, with a moderately conservative VLCA congregation in Bellevue. Once people got over the shock of thinking about Jesus being married, basically they just said, so what? That it really doesn't change anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's, but it opens up the question again. People ask, is that important?
Yeah.
One of the congregational members asked, is why is it so important for us to think that there's this genetic line?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Think about it. I mean, we as Americans are really fascinated by this book.
Yeah.
But we want this monarchy
that
traces itself back to Jesus. I mean, what's the point of is there going to be this surprise character that pops up? Because Jesus had brothers and sisters, so the genes are out there somewhere.
The genes are out there somewhere,
But what's the point of that?
There was something on the internet that we basically all share genes from people back then. We all have Attila Hahn's genes. We all have Leonardo da Vinci's genes. So what would be the chances of there being just one descendant of Jesus if he had, and especially look at the genes of his siblings. So that's disturbed me a lot. What's the point? So I got a little DNA, and how much would she have? I have pilgrim ancestors, and I figured out I have 32,000 relatives at that age, and I have 12 of them are pilgrims, while the rest of them are riffraff. What if you go back another, how many? I mean, it's exponential.
Yeah, there you
it's
go.
Nothing.
Yeah, good point.
The voice of reason.
Yes.
Voice of reason.
What about grandma? I mean, she carries the same genes. What about the grandmother? She carried the same genes.
Oh, absolutely. No, that's right. I mean, it's passed on. It's a matriarchal lineage, as Brown tells the story. Sure. She was the Grail, and then her daughter, and then...
Not the granddaughter.
I think, too, the whole idea, I mean, there are matriarchal societies. Ours is not one. That there are societies that trace identity through the mother and not through the father. And there's something about that part of this book, I think, that again touches on wider concerns about women asserting their own identity, discovering their own identity. And I would say this is less true among younger women who no longer necessarily take the name of their husband when they marry, but keep their own name. That used to be controversial 20 years ago, not that long ago. A hyphenated name was a scandal in a small rural community. What do the kids do? Who is the mother? Who is the father? Why both of these names? So things are changing. Clearly they're changing. So Brown, I think, is touching a chord of change that's, we're in the midst of it. We don't even know exactly where it's going, but we're in the midst of it. I think that's one of the ways in which this book at least touches on things that are very familiar to us. And I agree with your point. I mean, at the end of the novel, there is something unusual about these pages. It's a bit preachy. I'm a preacher too, so I don't consider that a complete denunciation. But it is a kind of different voice that we hear. It's not a voice that shows all of these artifacts of false history or the thriller voice, but it's a much more serious, I think, moment in the novel.
I don't think it's necessarily anti-Christian.
No, I don't
it's
either.
It's anti-hierarchical.
Absolutely, Clearly this is a story that fundamentally retells the ancient Christian story. No question about it. Is it anti-Christian? I don't think so necessarily. Because what we'll discover actually in the week together is we've been retelling this story from the very beginning. The Gospels are retellings of the story. They're not the facts and everything else is interpretation. They're engaged rememberings of Jesus and the early Jesus movement. As are these so-called Gnostic stories. Many of which were only discovered in 1945 quite by accident. By a peasant in southern Egypt who was digging nitrates, fertilizer, for his field and hit an earthenware jar which was full of these leather-bound codices, full of these Gnostic, these what we've come to call Gnostic Gospels. Some of them, he had them sitting around for years, apparently. They used them to start fires and some of them in the family home, and would sell them piecemeal. So they began to get circulated until eventually they got discovered by the Egyptian government and were brought to a museum and encased, so to speak, and eventually translated. It's really only in the last 30 years that these have become popularly known in our communities. Still, I think in many seminaries, the Gnostic Gospels really aren't read. We spend so much time looking at the canonical texts, which are important enough, but neglect all of the other sources that tell us much about early Christianity, which to me at least, is, as a historian, is crucially important. Yeah.
I guess my question for you and for others is whether you think Dan Brown actually cares about this story. See, this
good
is my question.
Yeah.
And with that my own answer is that I don't think he does.
I think
that as a storyteller, he sees that this is a great yarn.
Yes.
And that it could sell him a lot of books.
Yes.
So I think he's using the story for commercial ends. And I wouldn't disagree necessarily that there are moments like the passage you read where perhaps he is moving into a deeper place. Although my own opinion is that that's maybe his way. Yeah, it's his way to sort of step away from it. And it's like the ending of a Hollywood movie or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it raises, and I don't know if others agree with that or not, but it raises questions about the function of storytelling in our own age then, and such stories, because, you know, I'm an English prof, so of course, you know, I resonate deeply with all that you're saying about story and poetry and beauty.
Yeah.
And this is why the book didn't speak to me so much, because he's writing about all these things. I agree. He's writing about all these things that you're describing, but I don't think he really believes them. I don't think that, you know, and his own prose doesn't convey, it doesn't express those things directly. He talks about them without being able to show them, really.
Yeah.
So I don't
know. Well taken. I think you're probably right about the, you know, does Brown really believe this? I don't think so. But he's marketed it in a kind of perfect form.
Yeah.
And he's done his research, and that I think women do most of the reading in America nowadays, so he...
That's true. He found the audience.
Yeah,
he really did. That's a good point.
Yeah.
It reminds me of what you were saying about the painting that of Mary Magdalene, or not which Mary, but the one where you were talking about she was holding her finger.
Oh, yeah, Mary Magdalene, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How and you're talking about direct experience with God and through the arts and through poetry, but then the painting, whoever painted that picture, takes Mary and turns her away from the... I mean, how do you paint Mary sort of doing nothing in a garden except saying, I saw him? There's, it reminds me of what you said about the author then, sort of, well, I'll write this yarn and I'll sort of make money off it, or I can make a painting, I can have a product, but really there's no way to contain or express what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are some ways, but not ways you can sell and make a lot of books, maybe.
Now, some of the, if you think about the Jesus movies that have come out over the last 30 years, we've lived through some remarkable Jesus movies. Mel Gibson, the Passion is probably the least interesting in some ways, because it's a very conventional, a certain kind of Roman Catholic telling story. Mary Magdalene only appears in the very end as a weeper at the tomb. But if you think of Kazantzakis' book, The Last Temptation of Christ, which Scorsese turned into a movie in the 80s, which was reviled by conservative Christians, just as The Last Temptation was largely reviled by liberal progressive Christians. So it's interesting how these tellings of the stories have united different communities with interest and anger. But do you remember how Mary is portrayed, Mary Magdalene is portrayed in that movie or in the book? At the very end, Jesus is being crucified and he has this fantasy. He remembers his childhood playmate, whom he eventually scorns, spurns, and pushes away from him, Mary Magdalene. So she's forced into a life of prostitution. Actually, there's nothing about Mary being a prostitute in any of the canonical Gospels or in any of the Gnostic Gospels. And we'll talk more about that this week. But that's the story that we've told, that she was a repentant sinner. She was a prostitute who was rescued from her sin. And that story has been a compelling kind of image of Mary Magdalene and of Jesus' interaction with this sinner who makes good finally. And Scorsese did a beautiful job, I think, of capturing Kazantzakis' sense that Jesus, truly human, of course had sexual feelings, of course had a sexual life. And, of course, in the movie, it's a fantasy. It's a delirious dream that he's having at the edge of death. And, of course, what we know about people at the edge of death, there's something very, very understandable and even reachable in this particular version of the story. But there's something about the way we tell the story of Mary Magdalene, and particularly in movies. The movies have done marvelously at this and taken very different forms from one to the next. Mm-hmm. Zeffirelli's Jesus of Montreal, I think the best modern version of the Jesus story. If you've never seen it, go get it immediately. Fascinating story about a bunch of contemporary actors who are commissioned by the church to put on the Jesus story in Montreal.
Is there a practice?
Jesus of Montreal.
That's good.
And they eventually live their way into these characters and become these characters and begin to engage not just the world around them, but the church with passion and with frustration and with joy and with anger and the whole range of experiences. Brilliant.
Satan reappears.
Absolutely.
As a lawyer.
Certain kind of lawyer. Other reflections, comments? Yeah.
My son was just showing me a book he read today. He had to buy it because it was so funny and then so good at the bookstore. And it's all about Jesus' childhood.
Yes.
And of course it's all fictionalized, but it's kind of like a Harry Potter where he's practicing doing miracles and whatever. Yeah. But I can see a lot of authors going off on these tangents. You know, if it sells books... they're going to be doing it.
Well, one of my favorite episodes is actually in a Gnostic gospel, a Gnostic story of one of the few in the Gnostic collection about Jesus as a boy. He's on the playground, or the version of the playground, and the bullies are beating him up, so he turns them into sticks. I always wanted to know how you do that. How you take the mean guys and turn them into sticks. But so your son's onto a genre that's been around for a long time.
I think a controversial part of the beginning of the book, I think it's the first page, maybe the first sentence, he says, this is true.
This is true.
Right.
And you know, that gives a lot of people grief because you know, if they just not said that.
All descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. Yeah, what does that mean? I mean, again, that's sort of doublespeak. They're accurate to what?
In his trial transcript, he was put on trial for
plagiarism.
In the transcript,
and exonerated, by the way.
In his statement, he refers to that and says, "Well, yeah, there is that in front of the book, but he backtracks a bit and says that all these things exist."
Yes,
he doesn't say they're accurate. He say they existed, which gives him a lot of license. Just say, okay, these existed, and I'm going to change them.
Yeah, he was being sued by these three guys who wrote this book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. It came out in the early 80s. It was immediately denounced by all professional historians, and for the most part, not really read. They ought to be grateful to Brown, because now people are buying the book, which really was a minor seller in its day, and you know, giving it a whole new second shelf life. But they were suing him because most of the research, so-called research, that undergirds this book is taken right out of their book. And of course, Brown is very, very transparent about that. I think that's what
he mentions it in the book.
He mentions it in the book.
Yeah.
He gives them credit for it. His publishers were really smart on this. Their lawyers, let me tell you, look at every book that's being published these days for issues like this. So Doubleday got good lawyers on Dan Brown to make sure that there were disclaimers in the novel that the research he borrowed from other people. So that's what finally got him out. They said, well, you never, Brown said, I never pretended to invent this myself. It was published elsewhere. And Lee Teabing is a scrambled up name for one of the guys. Blagent and Lee are two of the authors, so even their names are used by the characters in the whole thing.
I missed that.
Yeah, it's riddled with symbols. And,
he is right about the floor in the Louvre. Mm-hmm. I was just there 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
It is. It is the herringbone pattern.
Yeah. Oh, sure. There are all kinds of things that are factually true.
I took a picture.
Sure. I mean, the Parisians are just so delighted, though, with these tens of thousands of Americans with a book in hand coming like you did.
The little sign that says, this way, to the Mona Lisa. Mona Lisa.
Exactly. Well, people have always gone to see the Mona Lisa, but now they go with this book in their eyes.
It's easy to get there because I've got all the signs.
They're sure looking at the Last Supper picture differently, though.
That's for sure. Yeah. I mean, it's been, actually, the Last Supper, I thought about spending a whole session on it. That's a fascinating painting.
Yeah, it is.
And it was painted for a Dominican priory in Italy. That's its original setting. It was a priory. And it's the only image we have. It's not the Last Supper, really. It's the story from John's Gospel, which is not really a Last Supper, as the story is told in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But it's the foot-washing episode. And so they're sitting at the table, and their feet, if you've seen it, you see that the feet are the most prominent thing you see. It was above the door of the refectory, where the monks, or the Dominicans, were eating every day. They looked at it every day. And they basically looked at the feet. And people have been working on this a lot longer than I have suggested, I think rightly, that this was a deliberate way of reminding the Dominicans that theirs was a life of service. They were there to wash the feet of their brothers and sisters and those in need.
So everybody's on the other side of the table.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So you're sitting in a monastery, you always sit on one side of the table, in the Middle Ages they did, so they could listen to a table reading. Still the old Cistercian communities do it this way. They all sit on one side of the table. So they're auditors, they're listening to the reading going on. And these men, all men in this community, would have been looking at this painting every day of their life, at the feet of Jesus and the disciples. Fascinating. A lot more to say about the painting. Maybe we'll get into that this week.
Angels and Demons will do better as a movie.
You know? Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe that's why they put this one first.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be like the Harry Potter, or no, Lord of the Rings thing. Yeah, yeah. Start in the middle. And
Angels and Demons only sold about 5,000 copies in its first run, until this book became a bestseller. Now it's up there in the 20 million copies or something. Well, I look forward to a week with you. For those who want to come back and hear more, think more together about this strange, frustrating, interesting, provocative book. So thanks a lot, and we'll see you later in the week.